You're listening to Feminist Current, making waves in the mainstream.
Let me clear space for you to sit beside me. You don't need your back against the wall.
You are listening to Feminist Current. I'm Megan Murphy. Today we're airing a talk by Janice Raymond called Prostitution, Not a Job, Not a Choice. This talk was recorded on November 30th, 2013 at the Vancouver Public Library as part of an annual event organized by Vancouver Rape Relief and Women's Shelter commemorating the National Day of Remembrance and Action on Violence Against Women and the Montreal Massacre, a day in 1989 when 14 women were murdered at L'École Polytechnique by a man who hated feminists. Janice Raymond is Professor Emerita of Women's Studies at the University of Massachusetts, Amherst. Her most recent book is called Not a Job, Not a Choice, Exposing the Myths About Prostitution and the Global Sex Trade. Here's that talk.
I'm going to talk about abolition of prostitution. And I'm also going to be talking about what I call the myths that people have about prostitution in general, abolitionism in general, and a lot of the issues I think that many, many of you are familiar with and that I really think it is important to speak about. I think one reason that we have these myths is that basically we have a media that is very entranced with the glamorization of prostitution and that idealizes prostitution as sex. We have a prostitution and pimp culture in which we live. We have a sex industry that is global, and we have a globalized prostitution industry that is essentially supported by the globalization of pro-sex work advocacy around the globe. We have men who are prostitution users who are there and who feel entitled to the access that they have to women. And we have a lot of, unfortunately, groups, including very progressive NGOs, who feel that legalization of prostitution protects women. It's simply a job, and it should be treated as such, or a service. We have the kind of cliches that really reign. Prostitution is inevitable. I was asked that eternal question this morning in an interview. Prostitution is the oldest profession. Legalized prostitution regulates the sex industry. Or in the more progressive media, prostitution is sex work. Trafficking is migration for sex work. Prostitution is a service like any other service job. Trafficking is forced and prostitution is voluntary. So I'd like to unpack some of those claims today. But before I do that, I'd just like to tell you just a little bit about my own experiences. As an activist, I've met hundreds of women in systems of prostitution whose lives have been ravaged by it. I've met women who thought they were migrating out of their country for decent jobs, only to end up in the sex industry. I've encountered runaway girls in my own country who left home because male relatives had sexually abused them and then find themselves smooth-talked by pimps in the railway stations or the bus stations across the country. I've been in brothels in Bangladesh and other places where I've seen girls as young as 9 servicing male buyers. And I've talked with a lot of men who are habitual prostitution users who feel entitled to purchase women and girls to meet their alleged sexual needs. And although, you know, a lot of the speaking I've done and a lot of the teaching I've done, you know, I certainly know that people react to the viciousness of pimps and the viciousness of traffickers, and they sympathize with victims sometimes. But I think a lot of often good and well-meaning people are really confused about the relationship between trafficking and prostitution, and about what it means to legalize a whole system of prostitution in a particular country. Because they're fed truisms such as legalization will control the sex industry, it will control the influence of organized crime, It will lessen the incidences of trafficking. It will protect the women in prostitution because it will regulate the system and it will get rid of all of the, you know, the excesses. And I know that a lot of people are, they've been fed those truisms. They're very unsure about those kinds of assumptions, whether they're true because they sound realistic. But often they don't know how to respond. So I hope today to do a little bit of unpacking about some of those truisms. When I began working on this issue in the 1980s in the campaign to abolish sex trafficking and prostitution, there were almost no NGOs and almost no governments that were addressing the demand side. You could never mention the men the prostitution uses. And it took almost 20 years for a solid block of countries to legally address, in a very modest way, the whole question of the buyers. First came Sweden, then came South Korea, then came Norway, and then came Iceland. And since these laws penalizing demand have been put in place, there have been a lot of arguments and a lot of attempts to overturn the laws. For example, the law in Norway, the conservative government that was just elected, was elected on the platform that they would overturn the law against the buyers. And unfortunately, they have been elected. So we'll see. We'll see what happens there. But I'd like to center today just on some of the arguments that have been used around the whole issue of penalizing demand and what the arguments are and what some of the responses to those arguments might be. I'm a philosopher by training, so I like to deal a lot in arguments. A big one is, instead of penalizing the buyers, governments should welcome prostitution users as partners in the campaign against trafficking and prostitution. We call these kinds of arguments, these kinds of programs, responsible Johns or ethical buyers. An example of this was the World Cup situation in 2006, which was held in Germany. And many of you may know that Germany has decriminalized many aspects of the system of prostitution, in some cases brothels, pimping, etc. So when the World Cup took place in Germany in 2006, there were women's organizations and human rights organizations that set up a campaign. And the campaign was actually called Responsible Johns. And what they did was they promoted an ethical version of sex tourism. Now, what that ethical version of sex tourism was that they distributed literature around the stadium where the men were coming into the football game in four languages, encouraging men to abstain from sex in the brothels that surrounded the stadium, and there had been specific brothels that were set up specifically for the entrance of the World Cup in that year, to abstain from sex, but only if the women say that they've got high debts with the brothel owners, or they're being exploited, or if the women tell the men that they've been forced into prostitution. Now, the question, of course, is why would a woman tell a man, first of all, that she's been forced into prostitution, and second of all, you know, why would he ask? Now, this has been a big argument of the pro-prostitution lobby. We can train Johns to be ethical. We can train Johns. We can train buyers. We can train prostitution users. We can train curb crawlers, whatever you call them, to be ethical. So then one might ask, well, you know, do these campaigns have any effect on the buyers? There's no literature from the World Cup in 2006 that says that that campaign was successful. But in 2010, the Amsterdam City Council did an internet study, a small study, sampling the views of men who used internet sex sites. They put the survey on things like the World Sex Guide, which is a very big global internet sex site. And they asked users, they asked prostitution users, to basically, well, one of the questions was, when you come across women who you think have been forced into prostitution, do you take any action? Well, the answers were no, across the board. There's been another study that's been done in the United States of 2,000 men in my state, in Massachusetts. And the study found that the knowledge that the women who have been exploited, coerced, or pimped, or trafficked failed to make any difference in the behavior of the buyers. They continued buying, they continued using the same women, even though they might have known this in some way, even though they thought they saw signs, bruises, for example, on women's bodies. So, you know, we don't have a lot of studies that have been done around this. I don't think we need these studies, but I think they're very useful in terms of talking about what are the results of these alleged ethical buyers campaigns. The government of the Netherlands has a hotline where a buyer can call in. It's part of the Crime Stoppers program, where buyers can call in and say they can register if they've seen any abuse. That hotline has never been used for that purpose. Same in Denmark. So, at any rate, that's one argument. Another argument is, and this is an argument that is very common in academia, that prostitution is too complex an issue to limit demand simply to the consumer of sexual services. Now, I say that's a favorite academic argument because, basically, it makes demand abstract. It kind of metamorphoses real-life men into market forces. And, of course, there are other factors that promote prostitution and trafficking. Of course, it's not only the demand. National and international economic policies, globalization, countries in financial and political crisis, natural disasters, like we see in the Philippines, where immense amounts of trafficking are now going on in the central region. Military presence, for which the United States bears immense responsibility. Racial stereotypes and practices. And, of course, women's inequality. But, you know, a prostitution market without demand would go broke. And so there are constant attempts in most of the academic literature on prostitution, at least in a lot of the women's studies literature that I am familiar with, that really does not want to talk about demand in terms of real live men exercising access to real women's bodies. And these debates go on all the time. Another argument is that penalizing the demand drives women underground. And I think this has been a particularly powerful argument in certain circles because people think, well, yeah, if you penalize the men, they're afraid to come up to the women on the streets or whatever. But then you have to ask, what is underground? This has been a big argument, by the way, that's been used in Sweden. Well, what underground usually means is that prostitution has been driven to some indoor site or to the internet, both of which are hardly underground or clandestine in ways that are not accessible. I mean, both the buyers and the police, for that matter, can access these sites. And advertisements on the internet are very visible. In fact, one could argue there that prostitution is more visible than elsewhere. And the 2010 report of the Swedish National Board, which evaluated the law in Sweden, came to the conclusion that exposure on the internet makes it easier for the police to reach people who are organizing the sex trade and to locate the purchasers of sex and to locate the victims. There is no evidence to suggest that laws penalizing the buyers, such as the Swedish law, the Nordic model, have caused prostitution to migrate elsewhere. Prostitution is always migrating. And its Swedish organizations, for example, claim that those who assist victims report that there has been no overall increase in indoor prostitution in the country since that law went into effect. And since the dramatic reduction in street prostitution, there has been an immense reduction in street prostitution. So the pro-prostitution folks use this argument all the time to say, oh yeah, well, it's just gone indoors. But there's a blatant contradiction in this claim as it's used by the critics, because it's very interesting that the critics will use this argument when they're against the Nordic model. They will use the argument to say that it's driven prostituted women into more clandestine and into more dangerous indoor locations. But for the most part, those who use that argument have been longtime opponents of the law. But when those same groups are promoting legalization or decriminalization of prostitution, they argue that indoor prostitution is safer for women. You cannot have it both ways. It's either more dangerous or it's safer. But they use it in both ways. And of course, their aim in the first instance is to discredit laws penalizing the buyers. I think this argument has been also very popular. Penalizing the buyers forces women in prostitution to take bigger risks. That goes something like this. They say that women on the street used to be able to assess their buyers, and they had more time before they had to jump into a car to see if there was potential danger in the car before agreeing to the transaction. But I really love Tricia Baptee's response to that, a Canadian journalist and survivor of prostitution who many of you know. She says, and I'm quoting her here, "I had 5 minutes, I had 2 minutes, I had 10 minutes. It didn't matter. It's the luck of the draw. There was no real way for us to know who was going to be a good date and who was going to be a bad date." I think what people don't know is that the potential for women in the legal brothels of the Netherlands, of Germany, of Australia, and the other legalized countries, the potential to be abused and harmed is much more likely than for prostituted women in countries where there are laws against buying women for sexual activities. This is one reason why, for example, pro-sex work groups in the legalizing countries are now writing self-help manuals which teach women in the legal brothels how to fend off violent overtures from buyers, how to use specialized equipment against the buyers, how to never use a pillow on the bed unless you want to get smothered, how to keep a knife under the bed for safety's sake. Self-help manuals. They resemble, as a friend of mine says, crisis management in hostage situations. And so, I mean, you can't take the risk out of prostitution, and buyers are a major part of that risk. The manuals are a backhanded testimony to the real risk that women, whether they're in countries that tolerate prostitution or whether they're in countries that allegedly say prostitution is safer for women, it's not. 1/3 of the window brothels in the Netherlands had to be closed because organized crime took over those brothels. I'm talking about the legal brothels, never mind the illegal brothels. In Australia, the situation of legalized prostitution led to a dramatic increase in illegal prostitution. So that now, in the state of Victoria, there are 3 times as many illegal brothels as there are legal brothels. So much for the argument that legalized prostitution protects women. The major tolerance zones. Initially, under the system in the Netherlands set up tolerance zones, we call them sacrifice zones, in the major cities like Amsterdam and Rotterdam and Eindhoven. Those zones all had to be closed almost as soon as they were opened, within a period of several years. These were zones that were policed. These were zones in which the customers came into these garage-like apparatuses, sex zones. They drive their cars into these places, and the women service the men in the cars. And the police, meanwhile, are going round and round the zone. But yet the zones were also taken over by organized crime. And that was the reason they were closed. And the reason they were closed also was because many of the women were abused in the cars, right under the eyes of the police. So the potential for women in many of these areas, and especially in the legal brothels, is very, very great, the potential for women to be harmed. Then there is the argument that women in prostitution don't want the buyers penalized. Now, the argument that women in prostitution don't want the buyers penalized depends upon which group of women in prostitution you ask. Those who define themselves as sex workers or those who define themselves as survivors. And I think we have to do a lot more talking about the fact that two conflicting voices speak for women in prostitution, and both claim the authority of experience. One voice, survivors, tells us that prostitution is a violation of women's human rights and a form of violence against women. It maintains that defending the rights of women in prostitution requires prosecuting perpetrators, including buyers, and also giving assistance to victims. And that doesn't mean just providing women with safe sex alternatives. It means providing women with life alternatives. And the second voice, sex workers and their allies, is often louder. It makes prostitution look sexy. It frequently commands more media presence, and it seems to enjoy at least more financial support. Those groups are in the United States, are getting much more financial support than abolitionist organizations. Just as an example of this, for many years in the United States, there was a group called Coyote, which you've probably heard of. And Coyote was the most influential group that claimed to speak for women in prostitution. Now, Coyote was entirely a public relations group. It did not provide services. It provided not even any kind of tea or coffee or vans on the street, nothing. Instead, it made prostitution look sexy, and it was always attractive to media. And for years, they were the voice of women in prostitution. Coyote lobbied for laws against pimping. They lobbied on behalf of the pornography industry. They went to court on behalf of the pornographers, but they saw themselves basically as the public defenders for normalizing prostitution. When we did some research about Coyote, we found out that they were not founded by women who had ever been in prostitution, but they claimed to be. And ultimately, they were put on the spot, and they had to acknowledge that. So I think that what we have got to begin to do, when I say we, I mean allies, I mean organizations like my own that work on these issues, and all of us in general, we've really got to be able to really amplify the voices of survivors, because they are the voice of experience, and they are the women who know what they are talking about. But they don't make prostitution look sexy, and they are not attractive to the media. We have tried to do some of that. Many years ago, we organized a conference of former women in prostitution at the European Parliament. And some of you may have seen this document. It's on my organization's website. It's called A Manifesto of Survivors of Prostitution. It's built on a similar statement that was originally written in the Philippines that was authored by 75 women in prostitution. And basically, that manifesto proclaimed that prostitution is not sex work, trafficking is not migration for sex work. It called on governments to stop legalizing and decriminalizing the sex industry and giving pimps and buyers legal permission to abuse the women in prostitution. And since then, there have been many blogs, websites. I know in Canada, a group of survivors testified in the Bedford decision. I think that this is really something that we really have to give attention to, because the pervasion of quote-unquote self-identified sex workers who not only identify, there's a lot of women who use that terminology, and this is not what I'm faulting. I am faulting really women who shill for the sex industry. And this is happening a lot. And I think we have to really begin to talk about this very seriously. And one of the ways that we can do this is to really amplify the voices of survivors in forums like this. So I think the arguments against penalizing the demand really do not hold up. I just want to say a few things about the South Korean model, because I think in this In this area of legislation, we always look to Western models for our examples. And I think a lot of you may have heard about the Nordic model, but you may not have heard about the South Korean model. Basically, the Republic of South Korea, in the year 2004, passed a zero-tolerance law. That's what it was called, targeting, among other things, the demand for prostitution. And included in that legislation were added resources to assist the women in prostitution. When I met with service organizations in Korea who provided this assistance to women, they told me that the most gratifying part of the law was the 56% decrease of women in prostitution that was reported several years after the law was passed. That was in a government study. That was the Ministry of Gender Equality who conducted that study in Korea. So a 56% decrease of women in prostitution, and that the number of sex districts had decreased also by about 40%. So what led to the decrease of women in prostitution? The assistance package that was really very much funded by the government, which provided counseling, job retraining, medical treatment, a monthly stipend, and legal support. And to qualify for that, women had to demonstrate in some way through the assistance organizations who certified this that they had been harmed or that they suffered from addictions or other disabilities or were underage. Thousands of women took advantage of that provision and subsequently exited prostitution. However, the decrease was also due to the fact that the law was enforced against the buying of sexual activities. Prostitution users in South Korea face jail time of up to 1 year or fines of up to 3 million won, which in Canadian dollars is about $2,800. In 2006, a survey of the Korean Ministry of Gender Equality also interviewed men who said that they were prostitution users and evidently reported that they had stopped using because of the enactment of the law. But more important than that, what the Korean women's groups also told me was that, and I'm quoting here, survivors of prostitution say it is like a miracle that they can escape prostitution through the protective system of the law. The experience that they who always believed they live outside the law are subject to the protection of the law, and that the brokers who seem to live above the law can be punished truly empowers the women. So they were hearing from the women, basically, that that law was empowering to them, and that the men who abused them could finally be made accountable for it. I will finish by saying that some of you know that the governments of both France and Ireland, after extensive legislative reviews, have submitted legislation against the buyers. And next week, the National Assembly in France will vote on an abolitionist bill that prohibits the purchase of a sexual act, puts an end to the criminalization of those prostituted, the Sarkozy law, which criminalized passive solicitation, implements exit strategies with a special budget allocation and the establishment of local mechanisms, gives access to compensation for victims of prostitution and trafficking, and puts into effect national awareness campaigns and prevention policies. The bill has been submitted by the left. They can't say, you know, this is a religious, conservative, moralistic bill, with most of the major political parties being in agreement. Now, I'm not saying that laws against penalizing buyers are perfect, and I am not saying that law is the only answer. But law is certainly much more than law. It's an indication of what a country thinks about what happens to women. It's an indication of the fact that in this land, women will not be bought and sold. And it certainly has an immense normative function. And I think that what it does is it demonstrates that prostitution is not inevitable. And it makes the users legally accountable. These laws are very modest. They are not felony laws. And in most countries, they are not even misdemeanors. But they do indicate that in this country, the buying of women and children will not be tolerated.
You just heard a talk by Professor Janice Raymond called Prostitution, Not a Job, Not a Choice. This talk was recorded on November 30th, 2013, at the Vancouver Public Library as part of the annual Montreal Massacre Memorial Event organized by Vancouver Rape Relief and Women's Shelter. That is all the time we have for today. I'm Megan Murphy. Thanks for tuning in to Feminist Current. Feminist Current is a syndicated show produced by Megan Murphy out of Vancouver, BC, Canada. For more information on the show, please visit www.feministcurrent.com. If your station would like to air Feminist Current, you can find episodes at audioport.org or email us at info@feministcurrent.com.